And our book today is a story of America's only unsolved airline hijacking. Writer Jeffrey Gray recounts what happened in his new book, Skyjack, The Hunt for D.B. Cooper. The day before Thanksgiving in 1971, a man boarded Northwest Orient Flight 305 from Portland to Seattle. He was wearing a dark sports jacket, a clip-on tie, and horn-rimmed sunglasses, and he took a seat in row 18E at the very back of the Boeing 727. And almost immediately, he ordered a bourbon and water and lit a cigarette. Ah, the 70s. Anyway, as the plane was beginning to take off, he passed a note to the stewardess, and it read, "Miss, I have a bomb here. I want you to sit by me."
She thinks he's kidding. So he looks at her. Mm-hmm. No, he's very insistent. He's stern. His mood changes, and she can tell. And he opens up his briefcase. It's a leather attaché case. And inside, she looks, and she finds red cylinders, lots of wires, and he tells her it's a bomb, and it's real.
Wow. So what did he want? What were his demands?
He wanted $200,000 in American currency and four parachutes.
Okay, so he makes these demands. The plane actually does land in Seattle, where it was supposed to land. What happens there?
Well, in Seattle, on the rainy tarmac, the demands are met. The passengers are all let off, and the money and the parachutes are brought on board directly to him.
And who's left on the plane?
It's just him and her. Her being Tina Mucklow, the youngest stewardess on the crew. And inside the cockpit, there are a pilot, a co-pilot, and a flight engineer who had never left the cabin all throughout the flight.
Mm. He orders the plane to take off again, and where does it go?
He wants the plane to go to Mexico City. And people thought, well, that's crazy. You know, under the way that he wanted the plane to fly, there was a tremendous drag, so they would have to refuel in Reno, Nevada. So around midnight, the plane landed in Reno. The aft stairs dangling in the back, sparks flew, and FBI agents raided this plane. And one of the things they found when they went into the maw of the cabin was that some things were missing. One of them was a parachute, all the money, and him.
And him. He was not on the plane when it landed in Reno to refuel. So somewhere between Seattle and Reno, Nevada that night, the man who became known as D.B. Cooper, this hijacker, escapes. And the presumption is he jumps out of the plane with a parachute and escapes, makes an escape. At that point, what does the FBI do?
The manhunt began that morning, and it was an epic manhunt that followed. I mean, one of the biggest in the nation's history. And one of the first things they tried to do, in addition to figuring out who he was where he landed. Now, this area of terrain to search is some of the most remote, if not the most remote, in this country. It is where Bigfoot lives. So they went about trying to pinpoint when the hijacker actually jumped, and they composed all different kinds of maps. And what they were able to determine after everything had been transcribed is that the hijacker jumped between the minutes of 8:12 and 8:17 p.m. For 1971, that's pretty good. To pinpoint 5 minutes, I think, is, you know, pretty impressive. The only problem is that if you're pinpointing a jump from a plane moving 200 miles an hour on a flight path that's 15 miles wide, where you're searching is hundreds of square miles long.
And they literally sent hundreds of people to trample through the forest looking for this guy or any trace of him.
It almost became a Thanksgiving ritual for people over the years, you know. Let's go in the woods and see if we can find D.B. Cooper's money. And not, it wasn't only lawmen in the woods. It was treasure hunters, amateur sleuths, reporters, just people curious to see if buried treasure was out there or Cooper's body was hanging from a branch.
I'm speaking with author Jeffrey Gray about his new book called Skyjack. It's a story of the infamous hijacker, D.B. Cooper. You, when you started working on this book, actually the inspiration for you to go ahead and write this book was that you got a call from somebody who said, Jeffrey, I know who D.B. Cooper was. I'm going to give you this information, and you are going to solve this case. Who was that? What happened?
Well, I had no idea who D.B. Cooper was. I had never heard of this case. You know, I'm a crime writer. I cover cops. I cover unsolved cases, and a lot of my sources are private investigators. In the summer of 2007, one of them, a guy by the name of Skip Porteous, called me and said, hey, we got to talk. And he told me the story about an elderly man in Minnesota who had contacted him. And this elderly man was just a kooky guy. He was an inventor. He was a retired post office worker. And he was convinced that his older brother was D.B. Cooper. And he had good reason to be convinced because his older brother, what I later found, looked exactly like the hijacker.
Hmm.
And I took off and followed the trail from there.
And you thought, I'm going to nail this thing.
big booty in this case. This is
right.
a huge case. To close the deal on D.B. Cooper is tantamount to finding the lost Dutchman mine.
This is a holy grail. This is a holy grail for crime reporters.
It's better than that.
Right. Except sadly, as a good reporter does, you did your work and you followed your leads and you discovered that, in fact, it wasn't him.
Well, what I ran into was something called the Cooper curse. And the Cooper curse is something that affects all Cooper hunters the closer they get to unmasking the hijacker's identity. And it's hard not to get obsessed with it because we just don't know. There was somebody who boarded a plane that night. So the fact that we don't know, the not knowing, continues to gnaw at me.
And it's amazing, you think about in this era of sort of terrorism investigations and the secure national security apparatus, that this is still the only unsolved case of a hijacking in U.S. history.
In the world.
Right. Nobody has any idea how it happened. And in a sense, it's like the perfect crime. Nobody was hurt. Everyone survived, and maybe this guy did. And he's almost heroically jumps out of a plane, gets away with the cash. And it's like a Robin Hood or a John Dillinger crime. It's this perfect crime.
Right. You know, there is, though, a difference between the D.B. Cooper myth that we want to believe in, but there's also the real story of Dan Cooper. And what I was able to find is that it's a totally different story, in my opinion. And I believe that the actual hijacker was somebody who was not a hero, who was a loser, who was a loner, who was depressed, who was after, in his last gasp, trying to make something of his life, the ability to achieve one fine thing.
Jeffrey, over the years, there bits and pieces of clues have been found, pieces of parachute, some of which may have been the one he used, some may not, bones, none of which were traced to this hijacker. But there was a decomposed cache that was found just a couple of years ago in that area, and that was the cache that was given to the hijacker because all the serial numbers were recorded. So parts of him or maybe Cooper himself landed. Do you think he survived? Do you think he actually made it?
I do. One of the things that I found in the FBI files was that FBI agents interviewed parachute experts directly after the hijacking who told them surviving that kind of jump, even in the trees, was possible. And one of the things we now know about the case is that the hijacker likely landed a little bit farther south than what the feds originally thought in that area is not as harsh as the legend of D.B. Cooper portrays it to be. It's a little bit marshy. It's closer to the Columbia River. Not a bad place for a parachute jump.
That's Jeffrey Gray. He's a contributing editor at New York Magazine and the author of the new book, Skyjack, the story of the infamous hijacker D.B. Cooper. Jeffrey Gray, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.